How will visual stories be made and distributed in a future of AI automation? The last decade has seen a revolution in platforms and content, which collectively provide insight into how the visual stories of tomorrow will get made. To share the landscape of visual stories, we welcome AJ Christian to the show. AJ is the founder of the Open Television Platform for Intersectional Television and an assistant professor of communication studies at Northwestern University. He is also the author of the 2018 book Open TV by NYU Press. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Television is not a new term. In fact, for years now, when someone mentions television, I drop my standard joke of, television? What is television? Similar to the way I do for outmoded technologies, such as fax machines. But while television may evoke images of obsolete living room behemoths for older listeners, it is really just a medium for transmitting moving images. While those images have graduated from wireless frequencies to cables to satellite telecommunication networks and Wi-Fi routers, they remain a form, really the dominant form, of visual storytelling. Far from obsolete, television is how visual stories are most commonly told, which is what makes the story of television and where television is going so interesting. Crucially, this fits into a larger trend. The reality is that visual stories have exploded in popularity. For example, my wife is a scientific illustrator. When she graduated with her MS in 2007, her professional association only advertised 2 open jobs. 2! Today, as I compose this show more than a decade later, there are 13 in the United States alone, and more than half that again around the world. While just one sub-community of a larger field, this example reflects an ongoing trend of using visual storytelling to bring complex science to life. As another example, in 2016, MIT released the Journal of Design and Science, the 5th issue of which was released in early 2019. Once upon a time, science was perceived by most to have no overlap with art and design. Now, consistent with larger trends in visual storytelling, from journal articles to grant proposals to conference talks, science is increasingly being visualized. While science is the example we're using here, it is just one of many contexts for which quality storytelling has never been more important. Much of this is driven by how the internet has evolved television. No longer a scheduled, synchronous, pay-to-consume model of corporate order overseen by major studios that are, in some cases, more than 100 years old, we now have a dizzying array of content from distinctively different platforms. These old-school players still offer their traditional forms, but they are joined by corporate upstarts like Netflix and Amazon, which have wrested creative control of the medium away from the majors. There are also more guerrilla services like YouTube and Twitch, which enable many of us in the United States, at least, to become creators as well as consumers. It is no accident that the prevalence of visual storytelling in our culture corresponds with the blossoming of platforms and tools that shift the locus of creation away from a trained professional elite into the hands of untrained everyday citizens. We already take for granted the forms of automation that enabled this change, even as artificial intelligence will accelerate the next wave of automation still to come. With that framing in mind, we are pleased to welcome AJ Christian to Creative Next. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Northwestern, as well as the founder of Open Television, an intersectional platform for new shows and series, as well as the author of the book Open TV. Let's begin with his thoughts about the relationship between the internet and television.
The internet, for me, is one more channel on TV's dial, but it's the most open and it's the most capacious. It can hold way more stories and data than cable or broadcast can. And for that reason, it's really interesting. So my book argues that that opens up TV to innovation. It opens it up to different ways of producing TV shows, different episodic formats and different lengths. It opens it up to new cultural narratives because the barriers to entry are lower. So people who have been historically excluded can now make their own TV shows and distribute them. So we see different kinds of TV networks, and they're more flexible and more producer-driven because of the dynamics of the internet. And, you know, now that kind of openness might be under threat, but I think it's undeniable that new media from the introduction of cable to the internet has opened television and opened our minds to what television could be.
Producer-driven is an important nuance to the current state of affairs. In the past, the distribution points held all the power. Today, producers do. And it's a weird reversal. Once upon a time, movies, 90-ish minute one-off features screened in theaters and then later available for home purchase or rental, held the power and prestige. You did television to graduate to movies. Otherwise, doing television typically meant your movie career was over. You were on the downward slope. Now, not only have the forms largely blurred into one, but the prestige moves in the opposite direction. Creator J.J. Abrams' TV success led him to the massive Star Wars and Star Trek franchises. Actor Rami Malek went from Mr. Robot to an Academy Award for Best Actor. Let's continue.
Yeah, open access platforms like YouTube, Vimeo, Twitch have been enormously important for the growth and expansion of what we call television. They've really been the space where independent producers are truly independent and can not only produce, but also distribute their shows and find their own audiences. That hopefully will maintain itself. We have now, as we are speaking, threat to the net neutrality rules, and net neutrality has been important for enshrining the ethos that everyone has access to upload and distribute their own content online. A lot of the conversation around net neutrality has been around Netflix and people getting corporate shows faster, right? And making sure that it's at the same level as linear legacy television. And that's important. I watch Netflix all the time. But it's equally important to make sure that platforms that are open, like YouTube and Vimeo, aren't incentivized to start closing down their doors or further tiering or creating hierarchies of producers on their platforms because the cost of distributing to consumers has gone up. I think that's something that has seemed so impossible in our current mindset that these open access platforms might not be open, that we haven't quite considered the possibility that they actually collect a lot of data. You know, gigabytes now are uploaded to these platforms every single minute. And they themselves are trying to survive in the television marketplace and actually make traditional linear half-hour, hour-long television. So they're already inclined to not care so much about the independent producers who might be using their platforms to start out their careers, but in 5 years could be at the level where they could be making long-form shows.
We need to keep in mind all of the data being captured in our digital consumption of content. That data isn't just being captured by a website like YouTube, but also by an internet service provider such as Comcast. That data is out there, and it may be used in unexpected ways now or later. Let's hear next about the relationship between production and distribution in television.
So this is, for me, an important sidebar in the relationship between distribution and development. It's one thing to distribute shows, right? Take productions, get them to audiences. It's another thing to have the resources to pay for the development of shows, to hire writers, to write scripts, to create pilots or pilot concepts. All of this is how television is made. And as YouTube and Vimeo have gotten into television development, they have effectively developed shows just like Hollywood, right? They hire executives from cable and broadcast networks, and they develop half-hour, hour-long shows. And the people who are using their platforms, who are independent and are uploading their shows to the internet, are not yet in that system, right? They're using YouTube to get into that system. But in this push to make big money and also a push to compete with the likes of Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and now Apple, YouTube and Vimeo, and not yet Twitch, have in some ways forgotten about the independent producers who made them platforms to begin with.
One of the byproducts of the last decade or so of independent and homebrew producers is in the diversity of content and form.
This is a question I struggle with every day, and I don't have the answer. I have a number of answers and possibilities. The short form way of doing things, the idea that a television episode can be 15 minutes, it can be 10 minutes, it can be 1 minute, as was the case with many episodes of Teachers before it went to TV land. This space allows us to tell stories in a number of ways from a number of different producers about so many different kinds of people. And so it's so critical to thinking about democracy and the ability to have markets that are truly diverse, right? Diverse, not only in terms of the identities of the producers, but also in terms of the ways in which things can be produced, ways in which things can be distributed, the kinds of storytelling strategies that can be used, business making strategies. In order for that market to subsist, the companies that profit from it have to invest in it. So there's one way in which we can see Vimeo and YouTube and these bigger corporations that own these open access platforms actually investing in those creators and considering it a developmental space, right? That you, when you invest in those creators, even though that might not be in your immediate profit advantage, it will be a long-term investment in making sure that you have exclusive access to the next generation of television creators. It's always boggled my mind that these companies don't think about this as a long-term R&D strategy in the competitive marketplace. That seems to me to be a case that is not going to be that convincing to these people. I've tried, I'm showing them through my own OTV project how it's not that complicated to do, and yet they still seem completely incapable of doing it. I think it might be the ways in which there's a relationship between cultural diversity and this incubator space where, you know, you have to actually develop a diverse talent pool to have different kinds of stories coming out and for that bottom-up grassroots energy of the web to be in your favor.
That's an interesting insight. The stars of YouTube and Twitch largely don't go on to be stars of traditionally produced stories. They may be used in some marketing capacity or leveraged for a cameo, but they for the most part remain in the window of our UI, inside the window of our browser, inside the window of our monitor. It's a tiny space in there, and conspicuously a space with relatively limited financial upside. It is a microscopic number of streamers who become truly wealthy. While it might make sense for an unemployed person to try and make a go of it, lacking for any other dependable income, someone with a stable office job would be crazy to forego that in the hopes of making streaming a viable primary income source. They would need someone else bringing in household income or to already be independently wealthy. It is curious that this talent resource is not being tapped more aggressively by the corporate players. What challenges do independent producers face?
I think there is another path to sustainable indie economy on the web that is about independent distributors, like my platform, Open Television, where we work with creators to help them make their shows. We pick up their productions for distribution. We put them on a website, and we're trying to gain our own audiences. There are a number of other indie TV distributors. There's usually always around 10 to 12 ones that are consistently serving audiences. Most of them do not last for longer than a few years, though there have been a few, like Black and Sexy TV, that's been around for about 10 years. Tello Films is still doing work. They're a lesbian platform. They've been around for about 10 years. There's a couple YouTube channels that, like Wong Fu Productions, that have consistently produced work for many, many years now. And now YouTubers are actually banding together and starting their own networks, like Zeus, which was led by DeStorm Power and a number of other people who have their big audiences and are asking their fans to pay them to deliver them higher quality content. So those are all done through YouTube or Vimeo. Vimeo OTT makes it very easy for entrepreneurs to put their channels on connected TV devices like Apple TV and Roku, which I think is so critical. But all of these independent platforms do struggle from marketing support. Algorithms are ruthless these days. There's so much content being developed for social media platforms, and of course, that's how you get the word out about your shows. Even if you have hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, millions of followers, getting the word out about your independently produced work when you've built your brand off yourself, or when you're combating with algorithms that are focused on what's trending that day versus something that's new, makes it very difficult to develop a sustainable business model.
Marketing is a challenge for rich companies, never mind for independent producers. There's the additional challenge of marketing for innovative forms. People conceive of television or online streaming content in a particular way. It is of a certain form, and that is a form that they've woven into their patterns around consuming the content as well. I can't really conceptualize how a one-minute episode of a show would fit into my life. Video content of that length that I generally consume holds little of my interest and none of my memory. If we aspired to innovate content forms, I might move away from the writer or artist perspective and instead approach the problem from a product management or marketing perspective. What are the use cases for different content forms? How is their design mindful of not just the galaxy of existing content, but the ways in which people want to consume it? What is a form factor that fills a gap in how people are living today in general and consuming visual stories more particularly? I suspect there are spaces for innovation of form that could become important and lucrative. Finding them will either require an uncanny amount of luck or intuition on one hand, or diligent product development work on the other. Shifting to technology, what are some ways that emerging technologies are being used in television today?
I don't think it's to the degree yet where people are making development decisions based on something an algorithm tells them. I still don't think that's practical. And ultimately, these are companies that are governed by humans who are making very human decisions about what to do. There's a big expose about Netflix's development process in New York Magazine a few months ago. And from what I could glean from the article, data informs some shows. It sometimes helps save shows. It sometimes makes it more likely that the platform will buy it, but they still have to be interested in the project to begin with. And sometimes they go against the data because they think the data doesn't tell them everything, which I think is actually a very smart move, because culture is still something that I think artificial intelligence is trying to grapple with. Culture is so complicated, it's ever-changing, so diverse. It's very difficult, I think, for AI to really understand how to develop culture in a way that actually will be sustainable to a business independent of human intervention. I know that there are experiences with telling stories using AI technologies, right? Or AR or VR technologies. And that also seems to be quite nascent right now because it doesn't quite scale. The beauty of television and the internet is that it's easily accessible to anyone at almost any moment these days. And AR and VR and anything that you might layer on top of that still seems not quite there yet.
Culture, similar to context we've explored in previous shows, is a big stumbling block for AI today. AI is simply not equipped to understand culture, much less to act in complex ways against it. And while Manish Agrawala shared some powerful uses of mixed reality in our last episode, for the most part, that technology, from the standpoint of being an important part of the consumer computing ecosystem, remains nascent. Thinking about the theoretical machine creation of television, there are many stumbling blocks.
It's such a complicated process, just making a TV show. It's so much more than having the idea for one. To get a writer or team of writers to actually commit to writing hundreds of pages of something, they have to be invested in it, and it has to be human-driven. Then, once the script is made, you have the director and the producer and the actor, and it's such a highly collaborative process. There's so many human beings involved in making these things.
And as of today, we don't have a machine that can do even one of those things well, let alone all of them.
I just think it's going to be a very long time before any of that process, any artificial intelligence, takes over the value of human intelligence. Potentially augments human intelligence at specific key moments. That will come maybe in the more immediate future, but I find it difficult extending beyond the development process. What shows do you buy? What shows do you renew? How are shows performing, and how do you get audiences to them? The actual production of the work itself, that is beyond my imagination at this particular time.
Agreed. But AJ introduces another interesting idea. While production of a television program seems safely decades away from machines even possibly completing, the mechanisms around making decisions about what sort of things to make or renew or spin off or otherwise develop seem well suited for the skills of today's AI. The sort of big data analysis and number crunching inherent in machine learning would be, at the very least, a valuable data point to consider, alongside the gut instinct of the trusted corporate executive, among other inputs. We shared some of the advances happening with AI and story writing with AJ, and he contextualized that intelligently with the production of television.
Television is different from short story writing. It's different from long form narrative. Dialogue is so, when it's good, it's surprising, I feel. And it feels like not stock, if you will, because, you know, most scripts that are written are basic and mediocre, right? And people sort of take the available language to talk about situations and throw them into a narrative. And I feel like maybe automation could develop a kind of B-movie genre film lane, maybe, but the things that make people human are the ways in which they say something in distinct ways and distinct contexts. And all the good shows that like last for many seasons have that element of writing that is real seeming. This is where I feel like I'm an old fogey, and I just feel like there's an aspect of storytelling that cannot be automated. But I'm also, you know, I have an aunt working on AI, and, you know, I see how she tries to meld linguistics with coding. And, you know, there could be ways in which you input an X factor or a randomized factor that just throws in something every few pages that deviates from norms. I don't want to say it could never happen, but I have a difficult time seeing it really scaling, because I feel like once machines start doing it, some writer out there is going to figure out what that machine isn't doing and write a show that's differently written, and that's what everyone's going to be wanting, you know? But that's just total speculation, because humans exist through storytelling and our world is shifting all the time, and we're in the world first before the machines are, you know?
There is an ineffability to how and why machines cannot do some things. We intuitively understand it is impossible, but do not ourselves have a structured enough mental model to map it with the gaps. Still, AJ is kind of getting at it with the acknowledgement that the world is always changing, and we are immersed in the world in ways that machines simply cannot be. Remember in season one, when we talked about the incredible successes of AI and defeating the best humans in games like chess, Go, and poker? Crucial to those initiatives was that the machine did not need to grapple with the variable of change. Each move it took was based on a snapshot of the current game state, which, convenient to those games, are entirely static. Once the opponent has moved, nothing can change. It is a snapshot of a moment that the giant hulking brain of the machine can kerchunk against. Whereas we intuitively shift our actions and understanding in real time as the world moves around us, AI technologies today are incapable of doing that. It may be a long time, or never, before they actually can. It is an important reason why we aren't going to be replaced anytime soon, and also the reason why machines will only be so helpful to us for the foreseeable future. So, can machines provide automation, or at least augmentation, in the universe of television production?
When I think about automation and production, my first framework is the production line, above the line and below the line. And that will probably be the line that demarcates the power of automation for me. So, above the line are creative people. They are the people we traditionally associate with making and telling the story. The writer, the director, the actors are super key above the line producers, also sort of executive producers, people who sort of come up with the conception and tell the story in the most immediate way.
AJ sets the demarcation line squarely at the creative. He believes that creative jobs will still be done by humans. That is generally true. However, tools we talked about in recent episodes with people like Snigdha Chaturvedi are already augmenting writing. From emerging tools like Grammarly and Hemingway to a vibrant future of writing assistants, automation does have an important role to play. It won't be taking jobs from people so much as it will be changing the skills required of the people who do the jobs. Using a visual story to illustrate this point, there was a great scene in the old movie Get Shorty. A gangster named Bo, played by the actor Delroy Lindo, is scheming with another gangster named Chili, and played by the actor John Travolta, about how they can take over production of a future movie. Bo explains that the story writing doesn't require an actual writer. You simply write down what you want to say, and I'm paraphrasing this to remain family friendly, quote, then you get somebody to add in the commas where they belong. Maybe fix up the spelling where you have some tricky words. In the context of this 1995 movie, it was silly, reinforcing Bo's ignorance. In 2019, it would be premonitory. Machines won't just add in the commas and fix up the spelling. They will suggest sentences to write as well. All of that does not dispute AJ's point about humans doing the work, just that the humans might be different. Let's continue.
Below the line are technical crew who execute the creative vision. And it's below the line that I feel automation might emerge first. I can think of automating cameras in the same ways that surgeons have certain functions that are done by robots, right? There could be ways in which it's controlled by the director, but maybe the camera, you know, which already happens in camera, right? The camera corrects for certain kinds of things and can be automated to make sure images are good at a certain level. That might increase to the mobility of the camera, framing, et cetera. Because there are certain basic rules to filmmaking that only deviate from super intentionally. And cameras can do a lot of that in an automated way. Potentially in the realm of lighting, potentially in the realm of sound, sound mixing potentially could be automated, potentially certain aspects of the costume process, depending on how sophisticated robot and automated and AI technology get, certain kinds of technical crew roles could be shifted to artificial forms of operation.
These are all possibilities over varying time horizons. In fact, on the hardware side, so much work has already been done. The technical skill required to shoot well with a camera in, say, the 1960s was substantially greater than to shoot the same thing in the same way here in the late 2010s. Advances in hardware like lights and cameras have already reduced the need for technical crew over the years, and technology of various stripe promises to continue doing so in the future. As we will learn next season, in some cases, composers in movies, television, and digital games have already been entirely replaced by AI equivalents. So, what about actors?
There has been concern, right, that actors will be replaced by CGI characters, and we were talking about how scripts might be written by robots. I have a harder time seeing that happening anytime soon for a number of reasons. One, it's very difficult, complex work. It's highly contextual. Every space you shoot in is so different. It gets very difficult to do. There are, of course, studio set comedies, sometimes dramas, that retain a certain format and a general lighting scheme that doesn't need to be shifted too much. So it'll probably be there. If it happens, that will happen. But I would also say that there is inequality within the Hollywood system as it relates to above and below the line that replicates broader inequalities in the US, where sort of more blue-collar jobs are under threat and are being downskilled or underpaid, but the people above the line are making more money than they ever have and are very powerful and unionized, right? So the most powerful people in narrative television are writers, and they're all represented by the Writers Guild, whether you are Tina Fey or you are a newbie writer and it's your very first show. And I think the Tina Fey's and the J.J. Abrams's and the Shonda Rhimes's of the world will very much resist automation above the line. I think the SAG actors, you know, your Will Smiths, your Meryl Streeps, who have the connection to audiences, right, will very much resist this as well. And I think it'll be very difficult to untangle that system. Even today, with all of the downward pressures on the cost of TV, these are people who've been able to get more and more and more money out of television, despite the fact that it's really not in networks' interest to do it. They have just immense bargaining power. And I don't foresee that being dismantled by robots anytime soon.
The challenges with replacing actors are real. In small ways, we've already seen these technologies on display, often when an actor or musical performer is deceased, but the creative work wants them to be present in it. Otherwise, there aren't many use cases in the market today for replacing a human actor with a CGI one, outside of performances that are all CGI or otherwise animated. AJ also touched on the financial inequities and that it is the lower-paid technical contributors more likely to be disrupted by technology. This is a fact of pretty much everything in a market-driven capitalist society with finite resources. The inequities are inherent to the structure itself. That isn't going to change anytime soon. Visual storytelling has become far more diverse in recent years. How do we build upon this for enduring gains in both the media we consume and our society in general?
I think it's really simple. I think a lot of people are nervous about how do we keep America on the path to being more equal and better for all. And I don't think it's rocket science. I actually think it's quite simple. It is you allow and empower those people who are currently and historically marginalized by these systems to tell their stories. It's really that simple. And maybe this even connects back to our conversation about AI and really the threats and my concerns about it. You know, one of my concerns is, will automated technologies make us think that it doesn't matter that people get to tell their stories? But it so does matter, right? Because to live through an experience is such a specific thing. It's all about the details and the minor things that happen to you. And the only way to understand it is through storytelling. You know, just this past week, just as a totally random example, I've had two very good artists that I work with who are writers and who are Black women talk about their experiences in the medical system and how both of them, with very different conditions, experiencing pain in a hospital or medical environment, were just not believed that they actually had pain. And both of them actually needed emergency surgery that day, but were told, oh, it's just this little pain thing, take a Tylenol, you'll be fine, right? And how do you understand that experience? It's not what, you know, you might think. It's not that the doctor's like, I don't believe Black women. You know, that's not how culture works, right? It's this very subtle thing where you know that what you're saying is not getting across to the person you're talking to because they don't fundamentally see you as human or might not see your humanity as complete as their own humanity. And that is something that you're not going to know about that experience unless you talk to someone who has that experience, right? And the only way to make sure that we ensure equality for all is to listen to each other and make sure that all of our stories are accounted for and all of our experiences are validated such that we can actually develop tangible solutions to correcting them and making sure that people can live in this country equally, that anyone has the same opportunity to have a good life, right, in America.
Storytelling is a powerful thing. Whether bringing us into the reality of people in a faraway place or into the life of someone who could live next door, the stories enable us to touch each other, to transcend time, space, and preconception, and open ourselves to other people and realities. It's powerful. It's magical. So much so that even I'm tempted to imagine that a machine couldn't or shouldn't replace us. But eventually, someday, it probably will. In the meantime, let's celebrate the diversity of stories that the technologies of the last decade have enabled. And on that note, let's finish with what AJ is most excited about in the years ahead.
I'm excited by all the people who have taken it upon themselves to make TV. I run a platform called OTV Open Television in Chicago, and we develop, we call it intersectional television or television that empowers storytellers who live at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, be it by race, gender, sexuality, class, religion, disability, citizenship status, etc. And we don't have a lot of funding, but every year more and more people are like, I want to try this. I'm going to get a crew together. I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to tell my story for my people. I'm going to tell my story for everybody, and I'm going to do the best I can. And every year the production value goes up, the amount of people who show up and get excited about this work, the interest from the press goes up, and it seems like people are taking it upon themselves to make sure that everyone gets represented through media. What concerns me is conglomeration, our reliance on algorithms and AI. I think we're losing the very basic fact that television is human storytelling, and it's best done when the most diverse group of people, the most representative group of people, tell those stories. And everything's very much focused on increasing profits, owning intellectual property, streamlining platforms, so only the stuff that trends gets to the top. And we're forgetting that it's not, culture is more than numbers. You know, culture really is about community. It's about social life, and it's about how we as people relate to each other.
Thanks again to our guest, AJ Christian. So John, how did our interview with AJ impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
A lot of narrative around change in the film industry, I think really mirrors the way automation is introduced through software in ways that we are not cognizant of until we're using it every day, and then it's just sort of what we do. And so AJ talked a bit about there's more capacity to tell cinematic stories on a lower budget because of the growing sophistication in camera technology. And I thought from, you know, my own perspective, when I use the iPhone and I use certain settings that make my photography look better, I just always use those settings because they use two of the cameras in the iPhone and create some depth of field in the portrait setting for photography, which, you know, if I was using a SLR camera, you know, you'd take some time to compose that and adjust things accordingly. With this, you know, it's just an automatic feature, and most of the time it works out pretty well, and it's all software driven. Yeah. And there's a little piece of automation that is really influential sort of at large, because it, you know, creates this broader pool of creators that can have some kind of influence in the industry simply because they don't need an entire crew now and really specialized equipment in the same way. And you see this again and again. You see it in the music industry. You see it in the software industry. You see it in a lot of creative industries.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned at the outset how, for me, television is like an anachronism, like the fax machine. Now I know that's wrong. You know, television as a term, it's not about that old box. So there was just some ignorance for me in what this space is, the terms, the sort of the playing field that AJ cleared up for me. And that was really useful in helping me to sort of understand and reframe television, video, visual storytelling, and other nuances that make my understanding of the landscape more crisp. So John, what did AJ say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, so AJ talked a bit about where the potential was for artificial intelligence to be used in the sort of film and television industry, especially along the lines of technical crew automation. So sort of describing the, you know, the writers and sort of the actors and executives as you know, sort of being the creators of this product, and then the technical crew more on the execution side. And I couldn't help but wonder, just, you know, and this is my familiarity with film and television sets is limited. I actually did a bunch of production assistant work when I was, you know, right out of college. So I have sort of decades old experience in the industry. But from what I saw from the production assistant side of things, the technical crews actually had to do a lot of things that were not replicable because, you know, when you're on set at a particular location, that location's different from other locations in ways that you can't anticipate and automate. Now, I could definitely see if more things get shot in front of a green screen or you're doing sort of close quarters, you know, interior shots, or if you're doing things like situation comedies or whatever, where the shots are not as complex or there isn't, you know, the same, the lighting's always the same, these kinds of things. I could see how that could get automated. But for something like, you know, Game of Thrones, where they're outside in Ireland shooting, I can't imagine that that automation will be coming to that part of the industry that quickly. So I was surprised sort of on AJ's take on that. And I'm sure it's depends on what kinds of film and video you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe the way it manifests is a little different too. And what I mean by that is, as the technology becomes more advanced and powerful, instead of one person for the lights, one person for the sound, one person for this other thing, there's only one person that's doing the lights and the sound, just as an example, right? So as the tools of light and sound and other aspects become more powerful, you don't need specialist, highly technical humans for each one. You can use more general purpose. I mean, that to me, that would be one way in which this sort of augmentation could move forward.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, in our interview, we actually covered a lot of historical stuff that didn't make the show. And the thing that most interested me was his sharing about Robert L. Johnson, who started BET, or Black Entertainment Television, in 1980. And I remember growing up in the 1980s, BET was on the dial. And I didn't watch it because as a child, I said, no, that's the black channel. And not that I thought there was anything wrong with it, but it just sort of explicitly wasn't for me. And so to me, it was just another channel among the hundreds of cable channels. But when AJ talked a little about it, it led me to research BET more. And I found it just generally inspiring and interesting. So it made me very happy that it was a thing on its own and the things around it in a larger cultural context. But it also helped me to go back and get in touch with some of the gaps and ignorance from my childhood and set my worldview then with the larger worldview and sort of who I've developed into today. So that was really revelatory for me. And I would suggest for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with BET, the history of BET, and how it fits into the greater framework of television culture and story, it's totally worth the time to dig in a bit. So, John, what did you learn from AJ that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Well, I thought there was an interesting comment that AJ said, talking about there being a certain point in the U.S. where we're going to have to decide what kind of media system we want. And I think we've actually had that discussion a couple different times and sometimes has not resulted in maybe the media, ultimately the media system that we would desire. There's an awful lot of media bashing right now, of course. And so I thought it was interesting that there is this need for a some kind of policy level discussion, which I think would cut across, you know, whether it's partisan divide or, you know, cut across, you know, different types of people, because
that's optimistic, John.
I think there is a discussion about you know, what kind of media system, you know, would be for public benefit, and would be for the benefit of voices that aren't heard quite as often. So I don't know if that's a discussion that's coming, but that piqued my interest for sure.
Mm. For sure. Yeah. You know, his organization, Open Television, which I encourage everyone to check out at wero.tv, it had way more shows than I expected when I was sort of researching it and learning. And they're the kind of shows that I personally like. So story rich, dialogue heavy, not a lot of special effects. I mean, that's my sweet spot. Now, the quality, you know, sort of the photography and acting, it's certainly not at the same level as the newest shows on HBO or Amazon. It's indie work that's on Open Television, but it's not off by much. And importantly, you know, the stories feel real. They're good, and they're smart and interesting in a way sometimes Hollywood struggles to be. So one I'll mention that I enjoyed is The Haven. That one, it's a good story in and of itself, but it deals with a nonprofit world a little bit. And I have experience in and around nonprofits. So I was identifying with some things, really funny, subtle uses of humor, while also learning about different people and situations and being sort of empathetically taken into the lives of people. Really, really good show. So for my life, I want to seek out more stories like these. I'm inspired by open television, not just default to what's on Amazon, what's on Hulu, what's on Netflix, but what are these independent channels? And open television is a great example of one, that I can enjoy and both get more out of for myself, but then also contribute to independent production. Each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what is an innovative form of television program that would fit into your desires in life well, and why? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it, @GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn more about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most: healthcare, education, and the public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach @DNiemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is @JohnFollett. Thanks to our guest, AJ Christian, who is on Twitter, @DrAJChristian. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the #CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 2, Episode 6. But here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
So imagine you're watching Food Network and you see like Garden making a chicken recipe, and you're able to say, "Hey, Food Network, send that recipe to Alexa or save that recipe." That's a superpower.